The Tigris River has been one of the most important bodies of water in the Middle East for millennia, but its recent history is one of neglect and abuse, and that's severely compromised its ecosystem. Efforts are underway now to clean up the river and its wetlands, and joining us now to talk about that are Humboldt Baykeeper Executive Director Pete Nichols and Nature Iraq founder Dr. Azam Alwash. They've just launched a group called Upper Tigris Waterkeeper, the first of its kind in the Middle East, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to today's Backstory segment. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay.
Hello. Hi.
Azam, Iraq has gone through a tremendous amount of turmoil in the last decade. Is environmentalism an issue that is one of the top priorities for most Iraqis?
The truth is no. Obviously, security and economy and development is higher in priority. The saying goes, environment is a rich man's concern. And so it is not on the high priority. However, we do have a Ministry of Environment now, and we do have a very active minister, and he has the protection of the environment high on his priority list, and we're working very closely with the government officials to protect the environment and to make sure that it's ready when the other issues are settled.
Pete, isn't Waterkeeper an American organization?
Well, actually, the Waterkeeper Alliance is an international organization. I serve on the board of directors. We have 194 organizations on six continents, actually. We actually have 67 organizations that are international in scope. And so Azam's program is our 194th. And so, we're an organization that was started on your Hudson River there by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Back in the 90s. And we're an organization of community-based clean water advocates.
And the group is focusing on the Upper Tigris in the Kurdistan area of northern Iraq?
Yes, that's correct, yes. And we're Azam can speak a little bit more to this, but it came to my attention when I heard on the BBC an interview with Azam about his marsh restoration work that he's doing down in southern Iraq, and he also mentioned that he was doing some ecotourism and wanting to look at the upper part of the watershed, clearly for water supply issues to the marsh areas. And so I contacted him, and we've been working for about 6 months to put the Upper Tigris Waterkeeper program together, and I actually just returned from northern Iraq last week.
Now, wasn't the crisis in the marsh areas created by Saddam Hussein's regime?
That's correct. The marshes were dried as an active effort to deprive the opposition of a place to operate from. Saddam, at the time when Iraq was unable to sell a drop of oil between 91 and 96, put every piece of equipment, quite literally, every piece of equipment that was available in Iraq and the services of a giant engineering project comprised of excavating six major canals, really rivers, and thousands upon thousands of kilometers of embankment, essentially depriving the marshes of their source of life, which is the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates. And by 97, only 700 square kilometers were still flooded out of 12,000 square kilometers that existed before. And so, the destruction of the marshes was, in fact, a political move that essentially was designed to deprive the opposition of Saddam Hussein of a place to operate from.
And what's the environmental impact been?
Well, the United Nations Environmental Program, a program that is not known for speaking very harshly to member nations, designated the drying of the marshes as the worst engineered environmental disaster of the last century. These are harsh words in political speak. Beyond the effect on 400,000 people who depended on the marshes for their livelihood, the environmental impact was huge. The wetlands of southern Iraq were a big migratory rest stop for birds between Siberia and Africa. They were acting as a filter for the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates before they went into the Gulf. The fishing in the Gulf, according to the Kuwait Scientific Institute, was dropped by 50%, the fish catch as well as the shrimp catch. The pearl beds that Kuwait made its living off of before the oil were completely dead as a result of all the silt and clay that got deposited on these corals that used to be deposited in the marshes. The temperature in the in southern Iraq rose by 5 degrees centigrade as a result of the drying of the marshes. Obviously the United Nations did not say this statement based on just hyperbole. It was in fact one of the largest environmental genocides that occurred in the last century.
So can't you just open the floodgates and let more water in?
That is, in fact, what happened in 2003. In March 2003, even before Baghdad fell by April 9th, the people of the marshes took it upon themselves to restore the marshes. And this is what gives me pause and gives me quite a good feeling that, in fact, the marshes are going to continue to exist because it was the people that restored the marshes. It wasn't some environmental activists that decided that the restoration of the marshes is nice for the environment. These people restored the marshes not because they're tree huggers like me. They actually restored the marshes because, in fact, their livelihood, their economy, depended on living off the marshes. From the marshes they fished, from the reeds they made their houses, they powered their ovens, from the young reeds they fed their water buffalo. And so the restoration of the marshes was made possible and is being made possible by the will of the people. And as long as these people are dependent on these marshes for their economy, they are going to exist one way or another. Simultaneously with drying of the marshes, of course, Turkey and Syria and Iran began building dams upstream of the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates. This is obviously because the water resources are very limited and the number of population is increasing. And obviously it becomes very important to grow food for the people. And so the dams upstream effectively have deprived the marshes of a source of fresh water. And so this is what took me from the marshes to the upper reaches of the Tigris and Euphrates. It has become quite apparent that, in fact, if I want the marshes to continue to exist for my children and your grandchildren to enjoy, we need to come up with a way for the region to work together to protect, first of all, the health of the Tigris and Euphrates and to manage it together. Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran have to work together on the management of these water resources. So this Upper Tigris Waterkeeper program is designed to be the first in many. I have plans that once this program succeeds, and I have no doubt that it will succeed, we will open other chapters to cover the entire basin. In fact, Pete and I are talking to a like-minded NGO in Turkey called DOGA about starting a similar program in Turkey. What we have to capitalize on is the ongoing waking up of the peoples of the region. I'm sure your listeners have been listening, tuned in to what's happening in the Arab world quite recently with loose social networks forming to demand their political rights. Well, soon enough, we can capitalize on the same movement to demand their environmental rights.
I'm talking with Dr. Azam Alwash and with Pete Nichols about the problems of the Tigris River in Iraq to some degree. In fact, largely a man-made problem. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Pete, the Tigris and the Euphrates are the area between them has been called the cradle of civilization. Mm-hmm. As Azam pointed out, some of the water has been dammed up and is not coming through. But what about the quality of the water that is going through? Don't people rely on it for drinking and also for agriculture?
Well, they rely on it significantly for agriculture. Unfortunately, I think the water quality of the tributaries and the Tigris and Euphrates at this point is not suitable for drinking. You know, but what we're looking at is simultaneously trying to improve water quality and water quantity on the Tigris and Euphrates systems. And what we're looking at here, you know, we have the luxury here in the United States of having the Clean Water Act and other environmental laws that allow us to enforce those laws to protect our waterways for not only the quality of the water, but also for public health. They don't have that luxury in Iraq. And so, you know, with this emerging democracy, there will be an opportunity to develop legislation, which Nature Act is very involved in, even prior to the Waterkeeper program being established there, but to work with the government to develop legislation for infrastructure. Right now, there's open sewers that flow into the tributaries, which ultimately are used to irrigate fields. Learning about water conservation. So a lot of
there's gravel mining that is being dumped into the river as well, isn't there?
There's significant gravel extraction. When I was over there last week, you saw several gravel operations along the tributaries. But what people don't understand here in the United States is that, you know, I also went whitewater rafting in Iraq. The headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates systems are very beautiful, very pristine areas. So I think a lot of the work that we will be doing in the urban areas is trying to do some education and outreach to the community, creating a sense of place for these communities, but also working with the local governments to develop infrastructure, water conservation practices. Right now they're doing flood irrigation as opposed to more significant types of irrigation that conserve water, doing those kind of outreach activities that will, you know, encourage water conservation.
Can an organization like Waterkeeper operate in a country that's a dictatorship like Syria?
Well, we're hoping to test those waters. I think with Azam's help and with the help of Turkey programs and you know, bringing a little bit of a higher profile to water conservation and community action to protect water. You know, this isn't only about the environment; it's also about public health. I think we might be able to get some traction in Syria, and in fact, maybe even in Iran. But we're determined to start small. And start very focused, and then move out from there.
Azam, when you founded Iraq Nature in 2005, were you encouraged by the U.S.-led occupation?
Well, the restoration of the marshes would not have been possible had it not been for the liberation of Iraq. So there is one instance where war was actually instrumental in creating an environmental good, ironic as it may be. And I'll follow up on Pete's statement. Look, this is one step at a time. We are cognizant of the difficulties associated with Syria, even Turkey, and more so even in Iran. What we're trying to do right now is focus on the success of this program. Once we create grassroots and create activism and are successful in at least partial clearing of environmental pollution in this portion of Iraq, we will move to other portions of Iraq, and hopefully our Turkish counterparts will do the same. And soon enough, look, Syria is going to have to join the rest of the world in letting the people of Syria more freedoms. And so is the same with Iran. I mean, who could have known? Who could have bet 10 years ago that Iraq would be a starting democracy, an incipient democracy? I certainly did not think that it was believable. And so it is now possible. Let's do what's possible, and let's dream big. As I say, you know, if you're going to dream big, it's free. And so we are working to putting the pieces together. We will put the coalitions together, and we keep on working at it until the mountain moves. just because it's difficult doesn't mean that we shouldn't start it.
Well,
so I am very encouraged with Pete and Pete's support and the Waterkeeper's support. We will be able to transfer their experience elsewhere in the world and translate it to actions in Iraq. I will say to your listeners that Iraq forever in its history has been using the Tigris and Euphrates as open sewers. And before the era of dams, dilution was the solution to pollution, as it were. People dumped their garbage, people dumped their sewage into the Tigris and Euphrates, and the water came in every spring with the mountain snow melting in the spring. It flushes away everything, and nature was able to heal herself.
Where does it drain?
It drains into the marshes of southern Iraq. These are the biggest retention basins that ever existed, and the marshes acted as essentially as a biofilter. It basically cleaned the water from the turbidity, from the silt and clay that it carries, from the toxins that came in. The reed absorbed all the heavy metals, all the toxins, the sunshine essentially oxidized, and the oxygen oxidized the water. And so the water that goes into the Gulf was relatively clean, and the biodiversity of the entire system was dependent on the free flowing of this water and this pulse of fresh flood water that comes in the spring. And so mankind, in its drive to control nature, has built these dams. And dams, the service life is only 200 years. It's but a blink in the geological time scale. Obviously, it is three or four lifetimes of a human. But I will tell you that these marshes existed in their form the last 11,000 years, at least in Iraq and before that elsewhere. It will exist. Nature is a resilient force. I am completely convinced of that. Before 2003, people were saying the restoration of the marshes would not be possible. There's not enough water. There is so much salt. There is too many things, and the damage is irreversible. Guess what, Leonard? Nature is resilient. All you have to do is introduce water, and she will take care of herself. Our job is really just to help nature have enough space and enough time to heal, and it will work.
Well, Pete pointed out that there's no Clean Water Act in Iraq, but what kinds of environmental protection laws are in place, and do authorities have much power to stop polluters?
Here we go. Right now, in fact, I'm working with a colleague that has been in Soleimani, and now she's in the United States, a lawyer by the name of Virginia Tice. She is doing with us and the Ministry of Water Resources and Ministry of Environment and Ministry of Agriculture an entire review of the environmental laws of Iraq. And we are about to hold next month a workshop where we bring in Iraqi academics as well as Iraqi officials to have a review of the laws and look at the overlapping mandates and the gaps in these laws and come up with recommendations for the Ministry of Environment of Iraq as well as the regional government in Kurdistan on how to work together to put a network of laws to help protect the water. Again, it's a stepwise function. We need to work one step at a time, but what I'm encouraged with is that the Ministry of Environment is very serious about working together on putting together the pieces that will help us force industry and force private property owners to protect this precious natural resource.
Hasn't the area also suffered from a major drought in recent years? Has that been hindering attempts to conserve water for the environment?
That is true. I mean, you know, there's also the issue of climate change, and the climate change is resulting in more frequent droughts than historically have affected the area. What I will tell your listeners is that Iraq and the region uses 92% of the water for agriculture in a very wasteful manner. This is the situation. The Iraqi farmer and the regional farmer is today still using the Sumerian method of irrigation, which was based on a time when there was a plethora of water. Essentially, the farmer does not pay for the water. The farmer floods the farms with water, and then the extra water, as it were, is drained back into the river, carrying with it a lot of nutrients, a lot of pesticide, and more importantly, a lot of salt that results from evaporation. This is a place where we can get a big bang for the buck. If, in fact, we succeed in changing the culture of irrigation from flood irrigation to drip irrigation to spray irrigation, it will result in a substantial savings of this water and, more importantly, affect the quality even better. What I tell Iraqi politicians that instead of buying 100 F-16 fighters, why don't we revolutionize irrigation by providing subsidized irrigation, modern irrigation equipment to the Iraqi farmer, not to save water for the marshes, you understand, but only to reduce the issue of salinity and the loss of arable land these outdated methods of irrigation. In fact, Iraq provides the Turkish farmer and the Syrian farmer with these subsidized irrigation equipment. It will result in a tremendous improvement of the water quality going, let alone the quantity, but let's talk about the quality. Just the water quality will improve to the point where, in fact, we can use this potable water that comes into Iraq for drinking. As we speak today, in the summer, some of the water that, or actually the water that gets into the Euphrates, into the Iraqi border, is recorded at about 1,200 parts per million salt content, dissolved salt. Now, the World Health Organization says that if the salt content is more than 1,000 parts per million, it should not be used for human drinking. Can you imagine? It's getting into Iraq in a shape where it cannot be used for human consumption. So the key again here is to create a regional program where the people of the area are working together, the governments of the area are working together for the benefit of management of this entire water basin of the Tigris and Euphrates.
Now, Pete, can some of the lessons we learned from the cleanup of the Hudson and other rivers be applied here, or is this a unique situation?
Well, it is unique to a certain degree where there's not existing legislation currently, but it is moving in that direction. You know, absolutely. You know, the Hudson River Keeper Program was started by essentially in the 1960s by commercial fishermen who were upset with General Electric and other industry for polluting their waterways, not because they were environmentalists, but because GE and other polluters were taking away their fishing grounds. So I think the waterkeeper model is exactly that.
Now, you mentioned earlier. Go ahead.
It's more of empowering communities to protect their waters so that everyone can be assured swimmable, drinkable, and fishable waters, which is the tenet of the Clean Water Act.
You mentioned whitewater rafting. Can you promote ecotourism in Iraq? Will people
absolutely
be going from Baghdad to do a little whitewater rafting in the north?
Oh, well, absolutely, and I think that's...
Let me answer that, Pete. Let me get in on this one. look, Iraqis are very good imitators. Here is the plan, Leonard. What we are going to focus on is providing the oil workers that are working in Kirkuk in southern Iraq. Hello?
Go ahead.
Hello?
Have you lost us, Dr. Azad?
Okay, now you're back on. What we are focused on right now is convincing the oil workers that are working in southern Iraq and in Kirkuk to come in and enjoy whitewater rafting. And I am confident that once Iraqis sees these crazy foreigners going down the river in these crazy waves, they would want to do the same thing. I mean, as it stands right now, a lot of Iraqis come in the summer to Kurdistan to enjoy the good climate here. It is a lot less hot in the mountains of Kurdistan than it is in the flat plains of Iraq. And so we have a good number of people that come in to enjoy the waters and to enjoy the weather. And the next step is basically putting them on the water and having them enjoy this part of activities in the region. There is also plans to create sales. Sorry,
I think we lost
the Dokan Lake.
I think we're losing you, and we have run out of time. So I want to thank both of you, Nature Iraq founder Dr. Azam Alwash and Humboldt Baykeeper Executive Director Pete Nichols, who have just launched a group called Upper Tigris Waterkeeper. Thank you so much for being on today's Backstory segment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.